Welcome back to the Don't Worry About It podcast, where we talk all things mental health related, from anxiety to depression, from happiness to sadness, and all emotions and feelings in between. My name is David Izzo, and I started this podcast to help facilitate conversations related to mental health topics. On this week's episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Shrey Gatte, who is 24 years old and was born and raised in Bombay, India. Shrey came to the U.S. for college and was working here for a big-time consulting firm. He had built an entire life for himself. And then the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and that changed everything. The pandemic has impacted so many people's lives in so many ways. And we had a conversation about dealing with things that we cannot deal, that we cannot control. Shrey is somebody who's exemplified unbelievable mental fortitude in dealing with so many challenges. We also talked a lot about the differences between the US and India, especially in dealing with mental health challenges. I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Thank you guys so much for listening. Shrey Gatte, welcome to the Don't Worry About It podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be able to chat with you. I'm really thankful to a big friend of the podcast, two-time guest himself, Effie Hirschman, for connecting us. I'm very, 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 very much looking forward to hearing about your perspective. But first, I want to let you give you a chance to introduce yourself. Who are you?
Absolutely. So my name is Shrey. I grew up in this Western Indian city of Bombay in India for 17 years of my life. I moved to the United States to study at the age of 18, where I completed a degree in civil engineering from Rutgers, New Jersey, graduated in 2018, and then joined the workforce shortly after. I was working as a consultant in Deloitte's New York office for about 2 years when I was laid off this June from my work due to the pandemic. And owing to circumstances, I was forced to make the difficult decision of moving back to my home country at short notice.
Wow. I mean, you know, COVID-19 has impacted everybody on so many different levels. But for you, that's, you know, even further in terms of, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs, but you lost, you know, you got laid off from due to unforeseen circumstances and then had to uproot your entire life and move back to your home country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I, you know, when I first received the email from my partner letting me know that, you know, that this is going to happen, I couldn't recover for it for the first few hours. I was just staring at the computer screen and thinking, oh my God. And I did have work that day. So, but I had to put everything on the back burner as I thought about what my next steps would be, because this is a country I've lived in for the past 6 years. I moved here at such a pivotal point in my life. You know, when you're a young adult, you've made so many connections here. All the social networks, the professional networks that I've known are here. So the thought of having to leave all of that and move back to a country, which, funnily enough, is now more unfamiliar to me than it was when I left it, I really had no clue what was in store for me.
I mean, I'm sitting here in just awe. Like, the amount, there's so many different aspects. That's unbelievable to have to figure out your next plan after acclimating to an entire new culture, new country, new cities, working. I know how hard people work at these consulting firms. You're working a ton of hours, you're setting up your own life, and then due to nothing in your own control, you had to do it. So you're sitting on a day in June, you got an email from your boss letting you know what's going on.
Right.
What was your next, like, how did that process go? What was it like for you?
So the first few hours were mostly just shock and awe that you know, that this happened to me. So to be fair, we were kind of primed that there were going to be layoffs a couple of weeks back on a town hall call that we had with our leadership. They did indicate that there will be some, you know, tough measures coming soon, and we kind of understood that that meant layoffs. But I was not expecting my name to be on there, because I was a consistently top performer and I had great reviews from my peers and people that I worked with. So you don't normally peg yourself to be the one whose head's going to be on the chopping block. But as I would later find out, that my visa status and the fact that I was on a, you know, student visa in America put me, you know, kind of put a target around my back, because it's easier to, you know, kind of get rid of us than someone who's already a part of the country. So that was kind of where I was at. And initially I was in a state of shock, but after that I recovered fairly quickly from it and decided that I need to spruce up my resume. I need to start reaching out to my networks, seeing who I can tap into to find another job, because I had about a couple of months to find a replacement job. And if I did find something within that much time, I could potentially have stayed back longer in the United States. But given that, you know, we were in the middle of a pandemic, companies had announced hiring freezes, and the economy was in it was in free fall, it became very difficult to find anything right after I was laid off.
Right. I mean, people are the economy shuts down. Companies have to make layoffs just to potentially even keep their own businesses open. But here you are, just somebody who's got not only has to now find new employment, but as I worked in recruiting for a while, and there's a whole other aspect that a lot of people don't understand, especially people that are from this country in America, where visa status absolutely 1,000% plays a plays a big part in decision making on who they're going to hire, whether it's they're on their student visas, OPT, H1B1. Like, there's so many different things that come into play with the company. Mm-hmm. So you now have to, not only, I guess, if I'm understanding correctly, you have to now find a new job with a company that's going to sponsor or do whatever, how that visa process works. If you wouldn't mind explaining that's also another barrier for you to overcome.
Absolutely. I always explain it as, you know, if you're from India and you're looking to find a way into America to, you know, start a new life, there's essentially three hurdles that you must go through. One, you must find a company willing to sponsor you. And not every company would be willing to do this because it's a huge financial and logistical burden. And only, you know, companies of the size of Deloitte or, you know, one of the big four, or Google's and Amazon's have the heft to do that. The second challenge is getting past the lottery, which is the work visa system. So that's the H-1B system. And, you know, you have a 1 in 3 chance of making it through that. And once you're through that, the third challenge is waiting for your green card, because there's such a long backlog of Indians waiting for their permanent residency in America. They say that if you apply for a green card today, you should expect to receive a approval within the next 12 to 20 years. So what we're looking at from the point you come into America to study to the point when you become a permanent resident here is a span of potentially 20 to 25 years of waiting.
And you're at the mercy of these systems that you have, again, no control over.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you're hit by a pandemic like this, which subsequently causes an economic downturn of its own, and you're left in the lurch. I know stories of people who have been in this country for the longest time, and, you know, there was this one man who was hiking in Colorado with his friends one morning when he gets a call saying he's been laid off, and he had to sell his new house, his car, and move back to India within a span of a week. So you know, this is a very far more common story than it you know, sometimes seems to be.
And the way we handle these things, I mean, the way you're describing, just being, you know, shock and awe, that I think people can relate to. But my first thing is, I'm waiting for the anger. I mean, the frustration, the anger, the upsetness. And you're telling me that you're sitting there in shock and awe, and the next thing you're doing is in action, sprucing up your resume, reaching out to your network. That is incredible mental fortitude that you show.
Absolutely. And I think it does come from, you know, being in this precarious position for such a long time, where time is of the essence, and every second that I waste or someone in my place wastes, you potentially, you know, lose the opportunity to get a new job, get on an interview with someone. So you're it's a race against time, and you know that you have only two, when you have 2 months, there's, it doesn't give you the space or the time to grieve or to, you know, let out a scream and be angry. You have to be on your feet at once and think about your next steps, because if you don't, you definitely are, you know, heading towards a very bad situation.
Well, I think everything you're saying is what you should do. And often, as we all know, as human beings, we may know what the right thing to do is, but due to feelings, emotions, and exterior things, we don't always do the right thing. So the fact that you were able to do that, unfortunately, it didn't result in, and you get an opportunity to be able to stay. The fact that you were able to do all of that is unbelievably inspiring to me, and I think is a testament to you. And I want to know more about how you became that person, as well as I want to, you know, we'll touch on where you're currently up to and your plans. But so you're growing up in Bombay, in India. It's a whole different culture to me. I'm just a modern Orthodox Jewish kid from Englewood, New Jersey, growing up in a different system and a different culture. I'm curious to hear, from both the mental health aspect, but just also what was it like? What was your childhood like, family life? Like, who are you? And where did you come from?
Absolutely. So to tell you more about the way in which I grew up in an interfaith household, interestingly enough. My father is a Hindu and my mother is a Syrian Christian, and they had a love marriage, which is very rare in the Indian, in the Indian context. And I'm a product of that. And growing up, I was always exposed to both of these faiths and, the kinds of viewpoints that they had about life and its challenges. Also, started moving into. I was very heavily involved in my academics growing up, where to the point where I blocked out everything else and made sure that that was something that I focused on, because that's again some that very unique to the Indian situation. And I think as coming from a Jewish background, you probably relate to that as well, where your parents just tell you that you need to, put everything else on the back burner and just focus on, studies, career, making a name for yourself. So that kind of lays the groundwork for where I come from. And on the flip side to that is that we never had the time to grieve. We never had the time to think about, our feelings, emotions, and they were always kind of swept under the rug. And you never, it was always seen as temporary distractions, and you were eventually expected to, overcome everything. And move on with life. So that was kind of the very general attitude that Indians have towards mental health. It also re results in comes up in other ways where, people don't often think that it's a real problem. They think you're just having a bad day. They think you're just, it's a temporary, fleeting moment, and it'll pass. And if you do try and, hone in on it and say, no, it's a disorder, they can get a little, how do I put it? They'll think it's all in your head, which, to be true, it is, but it's still like it's not taken as seriously as it is taken in other parts of the West. So that's kind of a gist of where I'm coming from, the kind of background that I'm coming from, where people definitely are caring, they're loving, they have your best interests at heart, but they don't quite understand mental health in the way that we do in America.
It's very interesting to hear. Just thinking, coming from like a strict, modern Orthodox religious background, right? I always think of, our system, and I think about it a lot more now, just on reflection. I kind of think of it as a conveyor belt, but there's limited options of like kind of like building out your own system. If you grow up in a certain town, right? If you grow up in the religion, there's only a certain amount of schools that your child that parents will send their children to. It has to be fitting the description of modern Orthodox yeshiva day schools, where they learn the Judaic values and the laws and the scripture and all of that in between. So you can only send your kids to certain things. You send your kids to only to if they're in the summer, if you send them to camps or so you're not really kind of being put in a bubble and you're not really interacting. There's only so many options you can go. Like I know kids. I have a very close family friends that growing up where they had five boys. Each of them went to the same middle school, the same high school, the same gap year program in Israel, and then are going to end up going to the same college.
Oh my gosh.
It's like a built. It's like you're building out like a whole. It's like a whole program where that's what you do. Some mix and match and have kids that go to different schools, but they all filter under that one thing. And then there's also it affects what colleges kids will go to and what they'll impact. Some will only send their kids to colleges that are strictly Jewish. The Yeshiva University is the most common one. Turo is another one. But even if they aren't, they'll send them to schools where their kids are. Have a much more bigger Jewish life, whether it be Maryland, University of Maryland, Binghamton, University is a big one, and there are Columbia, NYU, the ones around the city. They want them close to home. So there's a lot of things, and then with the mental health aspect to it, growing up, I was very, very actually very lucky, and I didn't realize it until later on in life that my parents actually instituted a mental health day for me and my brother growing up. If we were struggling with school, even if we weren't, my parents might actually, I think they just saw it in us. They would just say, like, if you want, like, they saw my own, like, do you, if you're, the parents, like, they see the kid, at least, you'd say, like, oh, we're not feeling well, we have a stomach ache. And the parents knew it's bullshit a lot of the time. Sometimes it was true, but, and they'd let me or my brother stay home for the day. And they'd call, and sometimes they'd take us out of school and just say, we're going to spend the day together. I always have a vivid memory of my father and actually one of our close friends, my age as well. I think it was a third or fourth grade. We both just skipped school and we went to an amusement park for the day. And they called it a mental health day. And I never understood what that meant then. And now I look back and now I'm like, makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
For mental health was, I think, definitely an America problem. It's much more open and talked about it in private. I don't think it's being talked about as much openly now. So it's cute. It's really cool to see the to compare and contrast the different cultures. And so you're growing up in this type of world. Did you know of anybody that may have suffered from anxiety or depression? I guess maybe did you realize in the moment, maybe with friends in your school systems, that they wasn't classified as it, but then later on in life you kind of realize, oh, that's what it was.
Right. So this might come as a shock to you, but I never knew that these were problems until I think it was in 10th grade where I started reading news reports about it, or learning more about it through the media. Because in the Indian context, we would always hear of depression or anxiety as adjectives, where you say, oh, I failed my math exam, I'm depressed. But you meant it was always said within the context of, oh, it's this fleeting feeling that I know I will get over eventually. But we never ever thought of it as in the pathological sense that we now come to see it. So that was my experience with depression, anxiety. And in retrospect, when you look at certain family members and you think back to certain experiences, you now I'm able to put a finger to it and say, oh, maybe aunt so and so, or this uncle that I had, that I would always notice this peculiar behavior from, might have just had anxiety, might have just had depression, and we never talked about it, or we never knew about it at that time. But back then, and even now for that matter, it's very hush hush, it's very swept under the rug, and not a lot of people talk about it because there's a lot of stigma attached to the to being diagnosed with one of these issues.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Now, to hear it there, like that feels like where it used to be here. I wonder if it's as it seems to be more uncommon where in India, but in America, it's, if you heard someone saying, I'm going, even therapy, the idea of going to therapy, is that something that people do? Is that a thing in India?
So here's where there's the interesting contrast comes into play, because America can tend to be more, and I know I'm generalizing here, but American society and family structures can be more nuclear, can be more individualist, whereas in India and other Asian countries, there's more of a collective communitarian sense to the family structure. And it's not uncommon for several families to cohabitate in huge mansions in the older system as well, and now in larger apartments. So there's a lot of people to turn to when you're going through a rough patch. But the concept of going to a medical professional to seek help is only now starting to gain traction. We, you know, like when if say 10 years ago you told someone that you had depression or you had anxiety, people would almost always brush that aside and ask you, are you like mad, or is there something wrong with you? But not in a very nice way. It was always seen as, you were seen as this anomaly, this antisocial element, and people would cast a lot of suspicious glances in your direction. So that has of course been changing as more awareness is created. But like you pointed out, going to therapy was never the normal recourse. Your natural recourse would be to seek solutions within your family, within through your elders, and possibly even through religion, through the community.
Yeah, I want to second what you said. We're in this podcast, we are going to be generalizing at some points, and that I'll throw that out. We'll throw that as a disclaimer. We're just two people speaking from our what we see in our current views, and then we'll be generalizing. And neither of us are professionals, and but we are just trying to create. I think this conversation will shed a lot of. I'm learning in real time a ton of different things. I've read about. I took a few classes on the psychology of different cultures and families, especially that work in America, from Eastern cultures, the Asian culture, Indian culture, the African American, like just different type of cultures and how they interact with family. And, the nuclear family is a very Western idea, and the idea of living with community, the communal aspect is something that I always get from my religion, right? The Jewish community is
Right.
so very, very powerful and very, very supportive. You can go to them. I know in Christianity, the church plays a massive role in organizing and helping and chat within charity and other types of work. So it's not an, it, but you don't, in America, you don't see the, at least in the modern Orthodox Jewish culture, the communal living does not really happen outside of their own family. You can see people living,
Right.
having their grandparents live with them growing up, or maybe an uncle or an aunt, if they need it in some sort. But the idea of living with communal families, and now you're talking about
the idea of, you know, maybe that's probably where they're going to talk to their issues with other people, as opposed to going to having that that professional outside resource.
Absolutely. That was at least the trend until fairly recently, where people would, you know, seek recourse within the families. It was also, I guess it was a double-edged sword. Like if you know, you did go to like a professional outside of the family to seek help, people were always, you know, talk about, oh, what would people think of us if they found out that someone from our family is diagnosed with this? You know, it's like there's a faulty gene somewhere. Is it something to do with our upbringing? It reflects poorly on the family. So the reason people would be hesitant to seek help for their mental health issues was twofold, not just because of the stigma that they were fighting themselves, but also because of the way it would be perceived by society at large, and the implications that had on their family or their communities standing within that society. So that's one of the chief reasons why people would be hesitant to seek support.
Yeah, I think that idea and that concept transcends cultures and everywhere. I think that stigma still exists, whether even though, you know, at least in America, going to therapy or, you know, having anxiety, depression is more common. You know, people doing it, but I do think that people do still look at people who do go out that way with at least some part of like, what's wrong with them? There's something bad about it. That stigma still exists, and I think we're doing a good job similar here, but I think there's still a lot of work in removing it, and I think that just kind of stems from a lot of different insecurities in our own selves. But I'm curious, you know, you grew up in a different culture, then you came to America at the age of 17, mm-hmm. To college. What was that like? You know, that's a huge culture shift.
Absolutely. It's, you know, thankfully for me, in my context, I had been to America as a child on family holidays, because I had extended family that lived there. So there was, you know, that odd summer vacation that you spent there. So I wasn't entirely new to the place. But when you're visiting a place on holiday, it's totally different from when you're actually living there. And I remember the first night I spent in my apartment in Rutgers, I was consumed by the loneliness and silence of this changed environment, because I'm used to the hustle and bustle of my city, which is not dissimilar to, you know, what you'd experience in a place like Manhattan. I was used to a lot of people being around me, because I come from a lot of people from my family cohabitated in my house. I was used to a lot of different things, a lot of noise, a lot of life, and moving into this quaint town of Highland Park on the outskirts of Rutgers, mm-hmm. Changed everything for me, because now, you know, it was pitch dark outside by 7 p.m. There was no one in sight. Shops closed fairly early. So I think I did go through a bout of, you know, I wouldn't say depression in the clinical sense, but yeah, like just because of the change in environment, the loneliness that elicited in me was something that took getting used to.
And that loneliness can lead to, right, that can lead to other challenges. Just, I mean, acclimating to a new city, a new all of that is massive, massive change. You're learning, mm-hmm. You're learning an entire new, it's basically a whole new world to you. Yeah, you had some exposure, and you had some on vacation, mm-hmm. but it is not the same at all as saying, I'm coming here. And I guess we may have skipped a step, but why did you decide to go study engineering at Rutgers?
Absolutely. So I think most a big part of that reason was in terms of opportunities, because there is a certain amount of respect and prestige associated with an American degree in the Indian context. And we also acknowledge that there are more opportunities available to people once they graduate with that degree, not just in America, but also back home. So now, you know, when you do come back with an American degree in India, you're looked highly upon, you're very sought after by employers. So that was part of the calculus. It's also, I wouldn't be shy to admit that the American education system, at least at the tertiary level, is far superior to the Indian one in terms of the research that goes on in the American campuses, the kinds of clubs, the activities that you can do outside the classroom, and of course, the quality of the course instruction itself. So for all of those reasons, I thought it would be best to pursue this degree abroad, and also to seek out and learn how to live by myself because I've grown up under my parents' shadow for the longest time, and I saw this as an opportunity to kind of break free from that, you know, nest and set out and live a life for myself.
I think that's really remarkable. It's inspiring to listen to in real time, and I'm going to process a lot of it as time goes by. You know, thinking about, you know, always resonates with me and my own upbringing and who I, the existential question of, you know, who am I and who do I want to be? And, you know, hearing you, the term that always comes to my mind is, you know, seeking that discomfort. You were looking to challenge yourself and to take on these roles and wanting the best for yourself are all admirable characteristics and traits and actions that you took. I think it's incredible. So now you move to a whole new place. I marry, you go to New Jersey, you're at Rutgers studying, you're lonely. How did you acclimate? What was that process like? How'd you adapt?
I think the first thing that came to mind was to try and leverage leverage social media to start building connections here, because I was starting from you know, ground zero. There was no one that I knew over here. There was no, like, a lot of, and it's funny because when you go to a school like Rutgers, almost everyone knows everyone else through high school or, you know, through middle school or somewhere else. There already are connections, you know, when you go into college. But for me and a lot of other international students like myself, there's absolutely no one that you know. And in the weeks leading up to college, where, you know, you haven't even gone through orientation yet, it can be pretty daunting to, you know, make that first move. So I remember, you know, I used to be that obnoxious kid that posted on the, you know, class of 2018's group page about everything that I could think of, you know, try and strike up conversations with random people. And I think that's where it all began, where I started it. And it all it takes is one person who's receptive to you, one person who's willing to go that extra mile to, you know, show you the ropes, to walk with you to class. And then, you know, that leads to somebody else and then somebody else. And before you know it, you know, you're integrating yourself into the local ecosystem pretty well. So that was kind of how I started it off, by, you know, trying to make these connections online. And then, you know, you just agree upon, okay, I'm going to meet you at the cafeteria at 2 p.m. after this class. Do you want to, you know, grab a bite there? And so, and then, it, you know, one thing leads to another, and next thing you know, you're friends. So that was kind of what I did to try and address the loneliness situation. But that fixed it from the social end for sure. But one thing that all these 7 years couldn't fix was the separation that you, and anxiety you feel from, you know, being so far apart from your family with who you spent so many years. And I think in some sense, the Indian and Jewish family are pretty similar in that, where they can be very overbearing, especially the mothers. They have, you know, they have your best interests at heart. They're very tight knit and tend to look out for you. Sometimes overtly so, but it, you know, can't complain. But that was something that was always missing from my life. You know, that every time festivals came around, I would always mention, I have no shame in admitting that I would cry myself to sleep sometimes, because I would, you know, think back to, you know, all the things that were probably going on at home that I would not be able to partake in. And there was nothing remotely close to that I could even do to make myself feel better in where I was at that point in time. So, yeah, that was kind of where I was at.
And when you were looking to, you know, connect with people, you know, I thought it was funny when you used the word obnoxious person who posts in the group. And, you know, anyone who's been a part of these groups on Facebook or any of these sites, you know, the person who comments the most, and you're like, what's that guy? And then, but honestly, as somebody who was always ashamed, like afraid of, I always had like a lot of admiration. I always like thought like that was, you know, it's a vulnerability to put yourself out there and be knowing that you could be seen as that, and the way you identified yourself as the obnoxious person. But for you, you know, you needed to you knew that you had a problem that was the loneliness, and you knew the solution was to meet people, and you were willing to take that gamble and that risk to be that person. I think that's really incredible. And then when you're looking to connect with people, were you looking to connect with other international students, maybe other students that at Rutgers that were going through maybe something similar that could maybe relate to you, being whether they were from India or maybe some other international country, whether mm-hmm. Whether it was China or any other countries or, you know, around the world where students travel to America to study?
So in terms of who I had no target audience in mind, and this it's very crude of me to say this, but beggars can't be choosers. And given that I was in such, you know, in such severe lack of social interaction, I was ready to jump onto anyone that was willing to talk to me at that point. So I, you know, and I kind of just, you know, cast my reel and try to see who took the bait. Of course, there is a certain level of relatability that comes from interacting with other Indians, but something that I tried to conscientiously do during the time of my studies at Rutgers was to break outside of the mold, because I felt like I've come all the way from India and I don't want to restrict my circles to only other international students that have come from India. I want to, you know, go out and meet people from other communities. And interestingly, that's how I ended up, you know, getting so heavily involved with like the Jewish community on campus, to the point of being, at one point I was one of the few people, the only non-Jew on a Rutgers Hillel committee on, you know, wow, Israel's relationship. So it was crazy how a lot of things happened, but I always made a conscientious effort to go break out of my mold, make myself very uncomfortable. And, you know, like a lot of the initial conversations, because we don't grow up with a lot of Jews in India. In fact, I've never seen one till I came to the United States. But, you know, I think that was the kind of experience that I was looking for, meeting people who don't look like me, who have not had the experiences that I do, and seeing how we could arrive at common grounds, seeing how we could relate, and you know, take things from there.
So interesting. How did you get so involved with the Jewish community?
I think part of it was, I was always intrigued about them, you know, growing up in India. We've only read about them. You never really meet any. And then once, you know, I came here, I was always inspired by the example, the kinds of, you know, the way they've, you know, risen to the occasion on every circumstance, no matter what the world has thrown at them. It's definitely a very inspiring story at large, but also because there were certain similarities that I saw between our communities, where we're both, you know, Hindus and Jews don't proselytize. They don't, they're not out to convert you or get you. So it's very, you know, I feel more at home that way. I don't feel like I'm being preyed upon. And then I, you know, also related with a lot of, you know, concepts within Judaism as well. Like, I know there's reincarnation, there's, you know, talks of soul, you know, transmigration of the soul, the lack of a, you know, system of hell and heaven in the way it does in other religions. I think there were a lot of it's very strange to say it, but a lot of commonalities between our two religions. So that piqued my interest, and I started, you know, reaching out to people within the community, going to Hillel meetings, and it just happened that I met someone who was willing to, you know, share so much about his culture with me that, you know, I was able to make these forays into the Jewish community up campus.
You are an impressive person, my friend. You are blowing me away, the amount of openness and willingness. And you know, for me, it's, you know, my exposure to anyone that differently from my culture was pretty limited. I think looking back, the only time I ever really got to interact with people that weren't from my background, right? Mm-hmm. Being a white Jewish modern Orthodox kid was and growing up was like town sports, whatever. Baseball, basketball, and that was only to like a little bit of an extent, and then that kind of bridges out, and you know, then the next exposure I got was when I went to college, and I got to talk to people from so many different backgrounds, you know, and they'd ask me questions about Judaism, and I'd ask them questions, what if they were religious or they weren't religious, like their beliefs, and you kind of when you get out of the bubble, you kind of see people for just that, they're people,
right?
They have different thoughts, different beliefs, and the more exposure you get to people that think differently than you. And most importantly, I think you use the word pray. And I don't think that's exclusive to any one religion or anything like that. And I think it's actually done by people trying to pray on other people and trying to convert them to their ideas and ideologies.
Absolutely.
It's not specific to just religions, right? They want you to think like them. And some people, and it's important to be able to have conversations where you can agree to disagree on things and say, here's my argument. I can tell someone my argument for something. They tell me theirs, and we can understand and appreciate the other person's argument for what it is, and disagree, and then walk away as just, you know, people, as whether it's friends or just decently treating them as just human beings. And that's something that I really think would go a long way in conversations going on today, and as well as just making the conversation around mental health. You know, everyone has their different ideas and you know, big differences between physical and mental health is you don't see it, right?
Absolutely.
You can't see inside someone's head, and their only way to explain, right? It is really hard to talk about how you feel and how you think.
Absolutely.
Because you're just kind of saying we're putting words to things that you feel, and they're not always accurate descriptions. What I we can both be experiencing the same thing, mm-hmm. but I can describe it way differently to the point where you'd hear it and be like, that's not what I have, but it could be the exact, you know, it could literally be the exact same
Absolutely.
Thing. And sometimes there are different variations, right? Sometimes other people do it, whether they have, whether it's with anxiety, whether it's depression, or it could be just a chemical imbalance. It could be borderline personality disorder. It could be schizophrenia. And there's so many different things, but we can find the commonalities and say, I'm someone who, like, as somebody who suffers from severe, who suffered from severe anxiety and has had a few bouts of depression.
Right.
When I hear somebody going through that, you know, for me at least, it becomes a part of, you know, when they talk about it, threading the line of making sure they feel heard and understood, and also knowing that, you know, actions still need to be taken, right? You need to help yourself. I'm going through this now. What can we, you know, do about it?
Absolutely.
And sometimes it's just a range of somebody. Sometimes somebody just needs to talk things out, and sometimes people just need to be heard. They don't need to be told. They don't need to be, and it wouldn't be good for them to, you know, plan for them and to do it all. It's just very, it's all very much subjective. And I think, I'm not exactly sure how we got here, but I guess it just came to my mind and I brought it up. And I'm curious to hear, you know, you have such a different background and you're such a diligent person. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Right, right. No, absolutely. I think having someone to hear you out, and I think that's what I was connecting to. I think you touched upon a lot of important points there. And taking it one step further, I think finding it's like they say, chosen family. That's what, you know, going out of my comfort zone and finding people that I could connect with in whatever capacity allowed me to kind of achieve, in a sense, because I was far away from my own family here, and that brought about its own sense of loneliness and you know, longing in my life. But putting myself out there and finding people, whether it's in a Jewish community or through like social groups that had a certain, you know, where everyone was united in a common vision together, I think that gave you a sense of belonging and was great. It was a great way to overcome that sense of loneliness that I keep going back to. So I remember since we both know Effie, interestingly, last year was the first time I met him, and I met him in Seattle, and I remember telling him at the end of the trip that this was the first time I was celebrating the Hindu holiday of Diwali, which is like equivalent in Hindu Christmas in scale and, you know, importance. And I felt completely at home with a bunch of Orthodox Jews. For the first time, I did not feel sad or lonely on this holiday because we did things together. And interestingly enough, it was a Shabbat. So, you know, they had their prayers, which I did not understand a word of. They had Kaddish and all of that. But it just felt nice to be with a group of people and have that sense of community. It doesn't matter that it wasn't exactly mine, or that they didn't observe my customs and all of that. That's secondary. But being able to find people who were able to relate with you at a human level, and who are able to listen to you and hold you close, I think that transcends any boundaries. And it was the first time in many years that I felt, you know, like I didn't feel as sad on the holiday that I normally used to. Of like mental health and why it's so important to, you know, or rather why there are challenges when you don't belong to the dominant narrative is because there are certain things that, you know, people, you don't, even if I do seek out a therapist, say in New Jersey, and they've never really had a lot of exposure to my culture or the way we operate or the way, you know, we think, it's easy for them to dismiss a lot of things that we might bring forth to them because they're not coming from the same reference point. Like, for instance, if I spoke of a lot of family related troubles, the ways I've sometimes heard people in the mental health field respond to it are not cognizant of the differences that arise from being Indian or being part of like the South Asian community. So I think there are, yeah, nuances there that are often overlooked or that never get addressed when, you know, you don't look at how these identities can intersect.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's something I learned in my psychology of different, you know, from different cultures and different races and different, you know, culture groups is that, and I think of it in my own, you know, in my life, I've gone to, I've seen, I think, four or five different therapists. Only one of them was actually an Orthodox Jewish woman. And she right. was the only one I was actually able to actually build a rapport with. And that was obviously for different reasons. I was older. I was more in touch with stuff. But also it was easier to explain somebody who knows what your culture is like, who knows what it's like growing up that way and can relate to you in that aspect. I think it creates a point for people to connect. So I think it's important to note that if you are going to seek, there are people who have success with other therapists that don't necessarily understand their background, but that I think that is a flashpoint in making a decision on seeking help is seeking someone that can understand you, right? You can explain to me what your experience was like, and I can explain, what my life's been like. But at the end of the day, unless you've actually lived it, I don't know, maybe you disagree. I think you can close the gap, but you can never fully bridge. The bridge is not fully connect ever. Can never really walk in someone else's shoes.
Exactly. And it's always good to have someone who understands the reference point that you're coming from when, they offer you advice. Like, as you mentioned, there might be instances where people find success with people who don't share that. But I've noticed that in terms of, talking about these problems, it's always helpful for me to talk to someone who at least knows where I'm coming from or is able to see it from that perspective.
Absolutely. And, now that I want to guys go full circle to get to where you're back to where we are today. You're currently back home in Bombay.
Yeah, that's correct.
And, as the pandemic comes to a halt, hopefully soon with the vaccine news coming out, I'm just looking for something to jump onto in terms of optimism here as an America, and I'm currently in New York where it's starting to really get cold, starting to get a lot colder,
right?
Dark, getting dark early, there's already seasonal depression. And now you have all these factors with COVID-19 limiting family time, that the risks of seeing family and seeing friends and all this other stuff that's going on. I guess what's the experience like been being back home in India?
Right, like you mentioned, there's we're all looking to latch onto some kind of optimism here, because this year has been pretty bleak, and right back here in India things are pretty bad as well. To put it bluntly, we're seeing a surge in cases, and according to several reports, we're in the top three countries in terms of fatalities and new infections. Right. So there definitely is a ball of gloom out here as well, and we don't even know how long it's going to be before we are able to procure the vaccines and distribute it amongst lay folk right. here. So there's definitely a lot. There has been a spike in a lot of mental health issues. I know from my perspective, at least, I've definitely felt this on my mental health as well, where I find myself scrolling. You know how in iPhones usually give you your screen time for every previous mm-hmm. week. I just keep noticing that for the last 6 to 7 months, my screen time has been like out of the park, where I'm scrolling all the time. And I think it's a manifestation of an anxious mind, where you're looking for some kind of change, something different to do, but there really is nothing. So you're just consuming media, you're just consuming memes and posts, and trying to get through this somehow, but sometimes it doesn't feel like it's ever going to end. But yeah, that's definitely been an issue here as well.
And yeah, I think that's very, very relatable. My screen time has gone off the charts for a lot of reasons. Some of it I try and rationalize and say, when I'm recording this podcast and I'm talking a lot on the phone, I think that plays into my screen time, and I'm using it for research purposes and reaching out to people to do like productive stuff for my life. And then I'm also noticing, I'm spending a lot more time on my screen. How is that affecting my mental health?
Right.
I was in the beginning when the pandemic first hit and my life was kind of thrown into whims. There was a lot going on personally. And then, I was like, okay, whatever, this is going to last. And I was like, there were some times where, I'd reach my breaking points where I felt like I was going insane. And, I started going on like hour long walks multiple times, a few times a day.
Right.
I was getting exposure to the sun to get vitamin D and just calling people. A good friend of mine, thank God, Javier, he's a good friend of the podcast. He's been on that podcast, Javier Ofer. I can't thank him enough. And a few other people I don't want to specify, but he was such a huge help. And now I look back and I was like in that place. I was like so long ago. Like 6-7 months ago at this point, and now I'm like thinking about the winter coming, like being very mindful about my own mental health in terms of creating a regimen. I was going to therapy before before the pandemic came, I didn't want to do telehealth, and now I'm thinking like maybe I should be doing it. And then there's also the part of it that's cost, right?
Absolutely, that's something I was going to come to as well. That you know, we all talk about therapy, like it's you know as easy as that. But I've discovered you know the course of the past few months of you know seeking it out myself that there is a forbidding cost to it, and especially in a time when people are getting laid off or unemployed, it's crazy. And also the sad part is this is the time that coincides with an increase in mental health issues, but right. People are unable to you know seek help because they don't have the finances for it. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think it's a big part. You know, there are, and I've spoken about this with some actual therapists on the podcast about the difficulties of finding a therapist and with other people. It's, you know, it's hard, right? There's a financial cost. There's also a time cost. There's a trial cost, right? You may go a few sessions, and those are, I call them, from based off what they feel like to me when I've done them, is information downloads, right? You spend a first two, you're just trying to give, I was trying to just give them my whole story, everything I possibly can, and be like, here's me, and okay, now we're hundreds of dollars later, and I don't even know if that person can actually help me.
Absolutely. You know?
And then you move on to the next person. It can take time. And I think, and I understand why people don't do it, and those are the costs, but it's like there are so many things that can discourage you. And I want to also counteract that point by saying it still can be, if you can afford it and you can change your budget out, and if you're really suffering, I do think it's something that people should try, but I also understand why they don't, right? It's hard.
Right.
As that cost, that can be, you know, right? A lot of people needed to cut their spending. Right. Mm-hmm. Before even adding that mental health challenge that they might need therapy, or maybe it's medication or psychiatrist and so many other things that go along with it. But then they're also, you know, they may have lost their job. So now they have an increase in mental health burden,
exactly.
New challenges to deal with and emotions that they're going through, as well as, you know, maybe their kids' tuition is now up and now they have to worry about paying their rent, their mortgage, all that other stuff is piling on top of people. And yet they have that cost of mental health. And also these people who are, you know, mental health professionals, they also have, you know, everyone wants to, you know, say, oh, therapy should be cheaper, but that's those person's time and what they need to value their time, exactly. As well. Because they also have, you know, they were all human beings, right? They have their own expenses, the same challenges we're going through. They could be going through, they're just trying to survive on their own. And now we're kind of at this inflection point where, I don't know what necessarily the solution is, other than, you know, people just understanding and trying their best to do their part in understanding themselves and what they need and working around it. And if you're somebody who hasn't done therapy or you don't think it's for you, I would say challenge yourself. And if you get to the point where it's not, then there are resources to find alternatives. Ask the best ways, referrals, you know, asking people what worked for them and taking that leap of faith and being maybe a little bit vulnerable. Maybe it's with a family member or a friend and opening up and just trying to do your best. Because sitting around and doing nothing, this is a thing that I think you need to be more proactive with than reactive.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's a great way to segue into what I was thinking about myself, where just based off that generalization that we'd made earlier, I think what we're coming to realize is that we need to lean on each other for, you know, surviving not just the bad times, but also in other times as well, through the ups and downs of life, because this is where I guess, you know, I built some kind of appreciation for like the Asian system of how, communitarian mental health issues can be, where people lean on elders or, you know, spiritual healers or leaders or people within their family to seek out this kind of help. So I think that, you know, that's something that can always be an alternative to therapy, not an alternative, but something that you can do when in lieu of therapy, when therapy is out of reach due to financial or logistical reasons. So thank you so much for bringing up that point.
Yeah, I think that's a really a point. And then there are some people, you know, I'm lucky I belong to a community, right? I have my religion is not it's not all of who I am, but it is a big part of what I identify with. And I'm lucky, right? I have some, and I'm looking actually, bringing on and coming up some actual people of my religion of people who are rabbis of communities,
right?
To talk about it from their perspective and what they can do and whatnot. But I think that there's, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, and I think part of what's creating a mental health crisis is the lack of meaning that people are having in their lives. And I know meaning can stem from so many different things, and it always leads back to the existential question of, you know, who are we? who am I? What do I want to be? And
right.
And when you don't, when you're lacking that value of meaning, and a lot of things are out of our control that are stopping us from maybe from knowing it, right? If you're somebody who's looking to explore things, maybe was hoping to travel the world, looking to find a lot of, that's how many people do, right? They go to Europe from America, at least they travel the world, and they people come back saying they had life-changing experiences. But with COVID-19, that's no longer an option, right?
Right.
Now, even you know, they say, you know, right, one of the things you can do is to not be alone, is to lean on people. But what if, right, like we're saying, you know, elders of the community with COVID-19, they're the most at risk. Some people,
right,
you know, we just had Thanksgiving, and I don't judge anyone. I think everyone needs to be as safe as possible, but also needs to factor in the mental health aspect that's coming with COVID-19, that of weighing the risk. And I don't shame anyone who's gone home and seen their family at all. I'm super supportive. And if you're somebody saying, I'm taking it too seriously, I can't see people, and as long as you're doing okay, then that's okay too. It's kind of blending that right balance of all these things,
right,
in COVID. And I think, I you know, I'm thinking back to it, what life would be like without COVID. And that COVID is, I think, accelerated a lot of issues that are now bubbling to the surface. I always refer to COVID as the great makeup remover,
right?
The great unmasking. It's or an unmasking of symptoms and problems that were bubbling, and people weren't made necessarily aware of in their personal lives, or their, could be within relationships or friendships, or even just their jobs and other stuff that's kind of brought that to the point where people are coming out,
right?
Maybe some people are coming out better, and some people are really suffering, and it's just brutal to watch.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I've experienced that in myself as well, where all this time spent with myself in my, you know, within the four walls of my room has forced me to confront a lot of my own demons, a lot of patterns that I've noticed from, you know, childhood, whether, you know, now I think about myself and I'm like, oh, I've noticed that I can be a bit of a control freak. And you know, trace that back to something in your childhood, and examples that you may have, you know, got from your childhood, where you see the genesis of this kind of thinking. You see why, you know, I look back to why, you know, some of my relationships didn't work out, or I have trouble, you know, being vulnerable with people on that level. And then you think back to things, you know, again, from your past, which may have led you there. So this kind of thinking would never have happened if I wasn't spending this much time with myself inside my head, you know, 24/7. Whereas, you know, when pre-COVID times, we were all, you know, out and about, trying to do enjoy our lives to the most, travel, eat out, meet friends. But now that you are with yourself, you have to confront these things that have been festering inside you for the longest time, but you never, you know, gave it any attention.
Right, and the word that when you're saying that came to my mind is the adversity that we face. Right, adversity is kind of I always think of adversity as a molder. Right, you go through trials and challenges, and when you come out the other side, you come out learning. Some people, you know, some people come out better off right away from it. Some people, you know, we experience things in it, and we may suffer at first, and then we come out on the other side. We come out with a newer perspective, a fresher perspective, and I don't know, it's subjective, but maybe even a better perspective than what we had before. And, you know, your story is inspiring to me. There's somebody who's had their entire life flopped upside down due to things. And you may even said, as a self-identified control freak, we're just, right? You thought, you know, trying to control whatever aspect
exactly
you possibly could, and then out of your control. And I'm somebody who looks at myself in a similar fashion. As I've struggled with my own mental health things and a lot of things of just trying to be, there was a period of time where I tried to be as unemotional as possible, growing up as an uber emotional person,
right,
that very emotionally act. I reacted to every one of my emotions. I would lash out or in any way possible. I was kind of just, I'd get an emotion, I'd just run with it, and I never tried to control it. And then I came to a point where I turned them all off. I did my best to turn them all off and to not feel anything. And, you know, then that didn't work for a while. Now I'm in the process of really coming to terms with it. And I've developed this platform to help, that's helped me and talking to other people, giving me new perspective on it. And now we're kind of going to that point of control again, where, you know, we try and control. I do preach, you know, a little bit to controlling your whatever you can control.
Right.
If you're somebody who's, you know, struggling, what can you do today that can help you, whether it's controlling your diet, controlling your exercise, creating structure around you? Those are some things that I know I've been trying to do a little better of. Even though diet, I'll call myself out, and I've been like horrendous with recently, and I think that's played a part and raised some challenges for me. But exercise, I every day I try and go on a walk for at least 3 to 5 miles. Just get out of my apartment, get out of it, get some fresh air, look at, go through Central Park. It's cliche, but it's not, you know,
right.
It's nice. And it create, and it's just more time that I'm not spent. So
absolutely.
I want to transition here and hear, you know, what have you been doing to help with your own mental health?
Mm-hmm. So one great way in which I have managed to, and this is my own form of therapy, and you've probably seen some of it, you know, over the course of the past few weeks, is my Instagram channel, through which I try and keep in touch with as many people as I can. So just for more background, I'm a self-professed extrovert. I'm like an extrovert. And this pandemic has been particularly hard on me because I'm someone who used to spend most of my time outside. I love being surrounded by people. I love, you know, social interactions. But now I'm confronted with a situation where I cannot, that is precisely the one thing I cannot do. And, you know, initially during the beginning, of, when all of this started kicking in, we used to have, you know, the online game nights and things like that. But, you know, that only took me so far. So I think that a large chunk of this increased activity that I started exhibiting on my social media channels, you know, the ones that are on public platforms, at least, has to do with me trying to stay in touch with people, because I would post, I would read something interesting, or I would think about something and, you know, boom it out there on my story or a post, and bam, you get like 10 other people, 20 other people that are having a similar experience, or maybe a not so similar experience, but have a different perspective on it. And they reach out to you, right? They slide into your DMs, they'll send you private messages, and they'll comment on things. And then you suddenly are having conversations with 20 other people at the same time throughout the day about these issues that are universal, that are, you know, some that resonate with other people as well. And I think that for me has been a big way of coping with the loss of social interaction that this pandemic has brought about. Just because I'm such an extrovert and I love being and interacting with different people.
Yes, that's really, really good advice. I think just finding your, for everyone needs to kind of find their way to figure out what they need. You know, in the beginning, I remember the pandemic, I would try and set up FaceTimes with people, and then that quickly died down. Now right. I'm looking back and it's like, I haven't even thought about doing that, like really for the most right. part, even like at all. And then there was like the part where like some people, you know, alcohol consumption would go up. And then I was like, oh, that's leading me to more anxiety. So then I stopped drinking right. for a while. And then I'm like, still like, you know, there's some nights where I was like, I may as well, like, I've been inside all day. Like, I may as well just go. I like when I was before we sold our house in Englewood, New Jersey, I moved back there from the pandemic. I
right. didn't
be in Manhattan. It was just to have the open space, especially during the summer, to be able to sit outside in the sun. And I would just be, and there's some nights where I would just go outside. I would say, I'm just putting my phone down. I'm turning on music. I'd pour myself like a little bit of scotch, and I just sit outside for an hour and just sip and relax. And that kind of, you know, that kind of worked for a little bit
until right.
like, you know, I was like, then I remember going out one night and doing, and I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, this is not what I need to do right now. And I just didn't, then I stopped doing that. Now you kind of figure out a new place. And I'm kind of just think I'm very much looking forward to looking back at how I acted and everything, God willing, when this pandemic ends.
Right. I mean, it's all trial and error, because this is not something we've ever experienced before. So, you know, it makes perfect sense that you would try all of these things. And you had the self-awareness to realize when, you know, where to draw the boundaries and realize that this wasn't working for you. Because a lot of times people don't tend to realize that the efforts that they're putting in might be counterproductive at the end of the day. So it's great that you were able to, you know, figure that out for yourself.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's just kind of the goal is to find what works and adapt, trial and error. Sometimes it works, sometimes, and making sure we learn the right lessons from things that don't work. Sometimes, you know, I'm a big fan of process over results. It's making sure that my process was good. Stacking the deck as much as I possibly can in my own favor. That way, when probability of life plays out, I have a better chance than not of succeeding. That's kind of how I look
absolutely.
At it, and understanding what, and separating what I believe is in my control and what is not in my control. And if I take care of enough of what is in my control to the best of my ability, then hopefully things will work out. And with COVID, you know, I'm a look aheader, you know,
right.
I'm already planning and figuring out, okay, what happens when this does end? Like, what's that going to be like? It's going to be a big adjustment, right? We're not as used to being as social and all that stuff and having to adapt back.
I know
yourself, extrovert, but I wonder if you've now maybe adapted a lot of introverted tendencies? Or do you think you're going to be the same?
That's an interesting question, and one that I get asked by my introverted friends all the time. Like, have you seen the light? Do you see why we do what we do? But
there we go again with people wanting to change everyone's ideologies, right? They want you to now be like them and be introverted, and you're, hey, I'm me.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to shift that radically, but I think it does speak to an important point where, you know, you have to grow comfortable with yourself, and I also would, you know, maybe say that a lot of times some of the extroversion that I showed and the ways it manifested itself might have been me trying a form of escapism, you know, of me not being able to confront problems. I think you could indulge in escapism as an introvert as well. You know, it's instead of losing yourself in parties, you lose yourself in books. But for me, at least, I know that a lot of times when I led that kind of busy bee, social butterfly lifestyle, it might have also stemmed from the fact that I was avoiding certain things that were going on in my head at that time. And I'm forced to confront it, I realize that, oh, maybe. So it's not that I'm becoming less extroverted after the pandemic. It's just that I feel less of a need to do a lot of those things, because now that I'm, you know, dealing with a lot of these issues actively, by seeking out therapy, by, you know, working on it myself, I feel like when I do come out of the pandemic, I no longer need to seek out these distractions to make up for what's going on in my head, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And there's something that's, you know, I don't know if I asked it earlier, and so if I did, I apologize, but you know, you are somebody who from India, then you come to America, you're here for 6 years and you have to go back. Have you been like keeping in touch with, you know, you made a whole new life here, and that,
right?
How have you been able to balance and stay connected, especially with the time difference?
Absolutely. As I would always describe to people that coming back to the city after 6 years is it's familiar but unfamiliar at the same time, because there's hardly anyone that I know here. All of my social connections, everyone's back in the States. In terms of how I keep in touch with them, yes, it has been a bit of a challenge with, given the time difference and the fact that most of them do work. So it presents its own difficulties there. But I think one aspect to it that that does work out is that we all are cognizant of giving each other space and like holding that for each other. And I think that's such an important concept in any kind of relationship, because, and also from a mental health perspective, because sometimes we forget that, you know, we have these lives going on and that things are not personal or they're not directed at you, and they're more so a function of circumstances at any given point in time. But when you do connect, it's like you just pick up from where you left off the last time, and it's almost like nothing ever changed, you know. So I think we've been pretty good about that without burdening the other person with expectations, because we already have enough of those with everything else that's going on. So the least we could do at this point, you know, towards each other, is to be more kind, be more considerate, and just hold that space for them to be, you know, to heal and to do their thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything you said there is spot on. You know, expectations is a big part of it. And I think it's also, you know, setting boundaries with people and doing what you're only capable of doing and not stretching yourself too thin, and taking care. Make sure you're taking care of yourself and what you need to do first. That way you'll be healthy and you'll be in your best shape to then be able to help others.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of times when things are out of our control, we try and latch onto anything that we can, you know, impact. If things aren't going well in our lives, instead of fixing our problems, we'll look at a problem that we can solve for somebody else and just to help ourselves. And maybe you're not in the best place to give that advice, or maybe it's not in your own best interest to do it. And doing for, and as much as kindness and doing for others is super important, it's about balancing that out and making sure you're show. I guess the point I'm trying to get, and it's something I personally need to work on a lot better, it's been a common theme in my life, is give the same advice to others and care and love that you give to others, and give it to yourself as well.
Absolutely.
Treat yourself the same way you treat other people, and that's with utmost kindness and respect and love and most importantly decency.
Absolutely. completely agree with that, and I think that's really been at the heart. I think that's one of the biggest takeaways of this pandemic, where you know you need to extend that same courtesy to not just others but also to yourself. Be kind. You know, I remember when I first lost my job, one of the biggest anxieties that I had was, well, how will this look on my resume? Isn't that crazy? That's the first thing of all things that I could be thinking about. I'm thinking about a piece of paper that's going to be sent to some company's HR department, and you know, even before I thought about its impact on me or finances, that's literally the first thing I'm thinking about, my career, my profession. But then you think about it, you think of in a life spanning, provided you're healthy and then nothing else goes wrong, what might last for 100 years, what are a few months, a year or two of finding yourself, of being out in the wilderness, quote unquote, or just taking your time to heal from the trauma that you're going through. It's insignificant. It's a drop in the ocean. And when you think of it in that perspective, you realize how small, and which is not to minimize it or trivialize it, but it's just to put it into a certain perspective and see that it doesn't matter. It'll get better eventually.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. It always leads me to something one of my close dear friends that I've mentioned before, Dvir Ofer, guest of the podcast and one of my favorite people in the world. You know, he always references connecting the dots from Steve Jobs' speech, where he says it's just really about figuring, the way you talk about with your resume, that was your first thought, and then how you come to the perspective of what's going to be a few months of my entire life, and understand the scope. And it's understanding that in real time, we have to be active now, but when we look back on our lives, we're gonna know so much more. And the quote goes as follows: and he goes, again, you can't connect the dots looking forward; you can only connect them looking backwards.
Absolutely,
so you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, whether it's your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Mm-hmm. This approach has never let me down, and has made all the difference in my life. Now, Steve Jobs is an incredible genius man who had a lot of incredible faults. Whatever your beliefs have been personally,
right,
he's somebody who changed the world. And that's a guy who really understood. And what I really look back from that quote is, we worry so much about how we're going to be thought of in the moment and what it's going to look like, instead of appreciating and taking it for what it is. And then don't try and have tomorrow's perspective today, mm-hmm, because it's not obtainable. It's not really obtainable. And that's something that always sticks with me. And I have to remind myself constantly, because I'm like you said, when you're a control freak,
yeah,
you're basically trying to write your obituary today.
Absolutely. You want everything needs to be done to the T. Everything needs to fall into place. And I have the exact same problem, where one thing out of the ordinary and I start freaking out. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is, this is not how I planned it in my head. And I think that's exactly what this pandemic has taught us, that you can't control certain things, but you can control how you react to it. And I think that's the attitude that will take us, further ahead in life.
I love that. Shrey, to wrap up, like every guest in every episode, I'm going to give you the floor now to give your parting thoughts, anything you want to say. The floor is yours.
Absolutely. So just since we've, talked about culture and how that relates to, things, especially in times of crises like this, I'm just going to draw on one example. So there is, curiously, in the Hindu tradition, the tendency to worship the goddess of destruction, which might seem counterintuitive or it may seem crazy at times, right? Why you worship constructive things, you worship things that are positive influences, but why would you worship something that leads to destruction? And I think something that, I've read about this earlier, but I've only come to realize after going through all of this upheaval, is that sometimes destruction is something that always precedes creation. And sometimes you need the old ways of thinking, the way you thought you were, the person you had constructed for yourself, to be destroyed for you to create something from scratch anew. And I think that's really what I've been realizing over the course of the past few months, where, this identity, this personality, this person that I had created for myself, this life that I created for myself, needed to be destroyed so that I could discover a better version of myself and move on and forward in life.
That's a really, really interesting idea. I know it's going to take me some time to think back on everything you said and process that, but I think I like where you're going with that, and I want to take time now. Thank you so much, Shrey. I really appreciate it. You're an incredible guest. I'm so grateful that you came on, and I really hope I know I'm going to learn a lot from it. I hope you enjoyed it.
Absolutely,
as well.
David. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Shrey for coming onto the podcast and opening up and being so vulnerable. I know I've learned a lot from him, and I'm better off for it. If anybody out there is interested in coming onto the podcast and telling their story or about what they've dealt with in mental health or just their thoughts and beliefs, please reach out to me. I'd love to have you on as a guest. You can find me at any of my social medias at the Don't Worry About It podcast, Instagram or Facebook page, as well as you can reach out to me through email at the Don't Worry About It podcast at gmail.com. I'll put the links in the show notes below. If everyone could please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, it would mean a lot to me. I'm really excited about the upcoming guests that I have coming on. I'm really excited about the future of this podcast. Thank you guys again so much for listening. I'll see you next week.